Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they
make. What an excellent day for an exorcism.
You wouldn't be able to do these awful things to me if I weren't still in this chair.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Who's in the box?
Put the gun down, baby.
Oh, what's in the box?
I said you give me the
what's
gun.
In the box?
Give me the gun.
Wolves have a territorial range of about 300 miles and a kill range of 30. If we're close to their den, and if we're within that radius, they'll come after us. How can we tell if we're close? We can't.
What in God's name are you talking about?
Your son, Mr. Thorne. The son of the devil.
Good say.
He must die, Mr. Thorne!
Do not want to go that way.
What's that way?
Officer, sir, you do not want to go that way. We're going to the mall.
Hello, Dexter Morgan.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of New York.
Hey, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I am fine, Phil. I just started my 38th grade of school, so that's fun.
Yeah, I think I saw that post on Facebook.
Yes, and did only one podcast this week. I did four last week, so hopefully this will be a little easier.
Yes. There you go. Because you did three with us, and then you were on the Dorkening, isn't that correct? Yeah, so people can go check out the Dorkening and see both. Who else was there? Was it you and Abe? Or?
It was just me, Leo Pond, Kevin Cook, and Wolfie and Yo-Yo.
Okay, so Abe didn't make it then, eh?
Apparently not.
Yeah, I guess not.
Yeah, I really wanted to, but it was just not possible for me because I was working at the aquarium, so it just didn't work out.
Yeah.
But I was so appreciative of the invitation, and I'm looking forward to going on that show in the future.
Yeah, I was invited too, but I unfortunately was stuck. Sundays are kind of tough because you know I have the two youngsters running around, and so Sundays is daddy time a lot with the kids because during the regular work, regular days I'm working obviously. So, but yes, I hope to rejoin them again. But everybody should check out The Dorkening, found everywhere podcasts are available, as well as YouTube. So there you go. So let's see, a couple of things. We will have Eric, co-host Eric, most likely joining us a little later. He's stuck at work very late. There was a big disaster, and as a result, he is off and on. He just texted me saying that he's still fighting the fire, as they call it, as programmers call it. Also, co-host Abe won't be joining us. He texted saying he couldn't make it, most likely because he did not want to see the film, or he just didn't see the film. No reason was given. I forgot. I think we have a Connecticut American here. Did I already
say that? You do. No, you didn't. It's Chrissy. Chrissy's here.
Oh, yes. I forgot you because you started talking about the Dorkening, and then
I'm
forgot.
I'm sorry.
Well, I know, which is fine, but then I said, oh, yeah, that's right. I never even introduced you. Yes, she's a Connecticut American. So, Chrissy, what do? You do things.
I do. I write short dark fiction, and you can find out more about me at www.ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com or just Google me.
Yep, there's only one Schoonover, so if you mess up the name, Chrissy Peterson Schoonover, it will pop up on Google, Yahoo, or whatever you use automatically. Also, you can go to the right side of darkdiscussions.com and there's a link directly to her book. Mike, you do things.
I do things. I do other podcasts. I have my blog. Blog is unnaturalselections.com. The other podcasts are You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast, Searching for American Gods, which is about the Starz TV series American Gods. And then occasionally in there, I try to squeeze in some sleep. How about you, Phil? You have another podcast you do as well, and some writing.
Yeah, that's right. I do the Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews, working on that episode now. That comes out on its own feed, but you can find it on darkdiscussions.com as well. And I do have a short story coming out in a book. Details will be announced later, but otherwise, if folks want to check out, they can just search for Perron on Amazon and Philip, and my short stories will pop up there. Let's see. So, who are we? New listeners, and for those who aren't familiar with us, we are Dark Discussions, where we discuss horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, technical thrillers, mysteries, midnight movies, grindhouse, and drive-in films. We try to talk intelligently about these genres that deserve intelligence, because years ago all that was poo-pooed, but then with Star Wars and Marvel and all these other things now becoming mainstream, horror and all that is now being reevaluated, and we are here to give it its due, as well as other subgenres. You find us at darkdiscussions.com. We also have a Patreon account where there's a link directly from darkdiscussions.com, or you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions, and where you can donate to the podcast. We don't ask for any money, but it would help, because we are trying to develop a new and improved website, as well as various other expenses, including the URL and whatnot. But what you can do is any amount is great, though none, again, is asked for, even though we are asking, and so I guess I'm contradicting myself. But if you do donate, and for every $5 that you do donate, you will get a chance to choose a film for us to review. So if you donate $15, you could choose three films for us to discuss, such as Death Spa, or Scarecrows, or Escape from New York. Or you could choose Escape from New York three times, and then at the end of every quarter, we randomly pick out of a figurative hat a topic from all you Patreon donators. So far, we have done a number of them, but we do have one to come, which is Straw Dogs, which Chris Genro had suggested. And in a few weeks, we will be pulling another name out of the hat. But as Mike has mentioned in prior episodes, the Straw Dogs will be in a bit, because we're hitting heavy season, Mike, right? We're getting a lot of films coming out back-to-back every week all the way to the end of the year almost, right?
Yeah, this is August was slow. The Meg was the one film that...
And Slenderman. Was,
yeah, the Meg was the one film that was, really hit the sweet spot for Dark Discussions in August. And then we got a bunch that may or may not be applicable or worth covering in September. And then, obviously, October is Halloween.
Suspiria.
And so there's a whole... Well, Suspiria's November, I think.
I thought it was October.
No, I think it's like first week of November is Suspiria, and there's some other movie coming out in November that I can't recall. And then maybe it'll start to lighten up, although once you get to December, you're talking about all the end of the year stuff and the, and things like that. So we will get to it. We promise. We just have to wait to get to a lull when a lull occurs. And, we just had something pop up that may get us to do another,
in-memoriam episode,
an in-memoriam episode. Correct.
Yes, and we'll discuss that in a moment. Also, there's a few VODs that have been coming out, too, that are pretty strong films that may be added to the mix as well.
Yeah, I've been hearing about those, too.
Yeah, so we'll discuss offline what ones we'll discuss. Anybody have suggestions, they can always email us anyway and say, this new film on VOD or this new film that's coming to the theaters, I want to... Want to hear your discussion about it. So you can always email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com. Now, Chrissy, the memoriam, there's a big news that of a passing today. Did you hear about this?
Yes, Burt Reynolds.
82 years old, they say. So he had a, I guess he had cardiac arrest and passed away. So basically, we could say old age.
Well, I think they said he had a heart attack, but yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I've been seeing. When I started seeing it pop up on Facebook, of course, I checked it first to make sure it wasn't old or whatever. But yeah, it's kind of sad. I mean, for, I think for probably, well, most of us on Dark Discussions, or at least I know I'm closer to 50, so Burt Reynolds was a big part of my childhood, you know, Smokey and the Bandit, and, you know, he, what's that, Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and, you know, just a bunch of movies that I can't even list them all right now. Cannonball Run.
What was the one that he did with Goldie Hawn? That was a pretty good one, the love story film.
Oh, yeah, what the heck was the name of that?
Yeah, that was a good one.
That was a good one, too, but he did a lot of really good movies, and he was really big in, like, I want to say the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, he was actually the world's biggest box office star from, I think it was 70, maybe off by a year, but it was like 78 to 82. And that was the, something that had not been the case for American box office in like decades. You'd have to go back to like the 1940s where you'd had, maybe it was Bing Crosby, where you'd had one actor sort of dominating the box office charts for like a 5 or 6 year period. And they mentioned at one point in one of the articles I read today that I think it was 1978, where they had 4 Burt Reynolds films in theaters at the same time. You know, Smokey and the Bandit, you know, if you look back at the box office, made like $120 million, which doesn't sound like a lot because this was 1977, but it was, that equates to like $500 million domestic box office today. And a comedy that makes a $500 million box office would be huge today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, comedies now, they're lucky when they top 100.
Right, right. Yeah, so millennials who don't know who he is, just for the fact that he was, his heyday was from a prior generation, and even his rebirth, when he did Boogie Nights, was still like 20 years ago almost. So, or it feels like it anyway. So he was huge, yeah. He was, as Chrissy said, anybody that's in their 40s would see him continuously on TV, magazines, movies, HBO, Cinemax, or whatever it was you had back in those days. And yeah, he was a big star. He was also a big sex symbol as well. So he was like, a Brad Pitt type of thing back then. And
right.
So
what was it? Was it Playgirl? What was the thing that he appeared? Or it was Cosmo, where he appeared like naked on the bare rug?
Oh, was it? Was it that? It wasn't Playgirl. I don't know. It's one of those. Yeah, you're right. He had this. Yeah, he did some sort of picture. That
and he's
famous.
One of the few men that ever appeared on the cover of Playboy magazine.
Oh yeah. Okay.
But yeah, it's so, and some people have suggested that might have hurt their chances at winning Oscars for Deliverance. I don't know if that's true or not. But yeah, I mean, he put himself out there.
Yeah, yes, he did. It's obviously with different times today, people probably would just ignore it or think it's cool rather than.
Well, yeah, that career. Wouldn't be a big deal today, but back then it was like huge.
Yeah,
you know, that was a big thing. It's just interesting too when you see these stars pass, you know, from days gone by, and it always seems like, geez, really, it just wasn't that long ago. It just doesn't feel like it was all that long ago for Smokey and the Bandit or whatever. I don't know.
Right. Well, go on, Mike.
No, you go ahead, Phil.
I was just going to say, even Boogie Nights, even though I said it's probably like almost 15 years, 20 years old now, it still seems only like yesterday, you know? It's kind of weird when I think about it, because that was Mark Wahlberg, you know, he's still big now, and he was just becoming big then. Heather Graham was actually huge at that time, Julianne Moore. I mean, so, you know, his career overlapped with these younger people that are still huge in box office, which is kind of interesting. Now, you going to say something, Mike?
Yeah, I said, well, it's odd because, you know, when we're growing up and there, you know, people die Jimmy Stewart dies, or
Robert Mitchum.
Somebody dies, like they were like our grandparents' generation, and it's kind of like, well, yeah, I've seen them in, they're old people, and I've seen them in really old movies, but now we're getting to the point, like Burt Reynolds dying is, you know, he's a guy that's almost my father's age. He's about 5 years older than my father, but that's my father's generation, right?
Yeah, he's 4 years younger than my father.
So right, but so that has a different meaning. You know, you remember these actors when their movies were new.
Boogie Nights was 21 years old. Holy
shit. Right.
When
they were in their prime, right? We remember when Burt Reynolds was a sex symbol. And, you know, if you were alive that time, Burt Reynolds was always linked to a string of hot, and I mean hot isn't both popular and what Phil would term hot context, you know, actresses like Lonnie Anderson. And to see him now, you know, eventually
Sally Field
was another one, right? His co-star in the Smoking the Bandit films. So it's just, you know, and so when we say, oh wow, why are all these big stars dying now? You know, it's, well, because they're getting old now. And it's not that the big star is just dying, it's that why are the stars of our generation dying now? You know, or big for our generation. Like, for our generation, it'll be like when Tom Hanks dies, right? Or Harrison Ford, you know, as they start getting closer to, well, actually, Harrison Ford's my father's age. As they start getting closer to actors of our own age group, you know, that'll be another realization, because then that's our group that's going. But, you know, now Burt Reynolds is to Abe, you know, what? You know,
Jimmy Stewart and whoever was us. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, you know, it's sad. He's made it to 82. It doesn't feel like it because we remember him as a younger time. But, you know, he's got a lot of films that I don't know how they hold up. I haven't watched. Actually, that's not true. I think I watched Cannonball Run last year because it just happened upon it on cable. I can't say it was a good movie, but I had fun rewatching it. But like, I don't know how well Smoking the Bandit holds up. Apparently, that was Alfred Hitchcock's favorite film. Go figure.
It's still a lot of fun. I watched it, like, God, was it last year? It might have been last year, because remember, I had my surgery, so I was laid up. And I was just watching all kinds of crap, like just anything I was in the mood for. And I think that was one of the ones that Charles had. And I was like, you know what? I feel like watching Smokey and the Bandit today. And it was fun. It was still fun. And for those of us who saw it when we were younger, you know, whether or not it holds up or not is almost not really the question, because it's a nostalgic thing. And movies were different then. And even when you go back and watch some of these things in the 70s and 80s, these movies that were real groundbreakers, they're corny. You know, a lot of them are just, it's just, it was a product of the time, you know? So.
Yeah, but like, I just rewatched the movie Running Man. It was on sale on Vudu, so I purchased it. And ever since we did the Human Hunting's Human episode, Phil, that was back 7 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I was sort of itching to rewatch that movie, and you couldn't find it anywhere. It was out of print. And, the Arnold Schwarzenegger film. And I rewatched the other night. And Richard Dawson, another late actor, you know, died recently, was awesome in that film. But there's so much that doesn't hold up. There's terrible production values. A lot of the staging and the action is very weak. It's very, very dated.
Hi, this is Eric. I disagree.
Hi, Eric. No, it is not. It's a fun film for the nostalgic purposes that Chrissy is talking about. But you do sometimes hope that these movies you remember fondly will be able to be appreciated beyond their time, right? You want them to be able to hold up. And some of them do, right? Some of them will hold up. You know, Casablanca holds up, where other things maybe don't. And it's just, so you do hope that they're going to carry on forward. And so I'm curious to see what happens with Reynolds. And I think there may be a film we do in the near future that I believe holds up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That film most certainly holds up. It's one of the best films of all time.
Yeah, it really delivers.
It sure does. Yeah. James Dickey. He's the man.
We are of course talking about Deliverance. So.
And John Borman and James Dickey together. I mean, that's a made in heaven.
Well, who would have figured? Because Ned Beatty's still with us, isn't he? Or is he? Did he die?
No, he's still with us. Yeah. And John Voight is still with us. But Ronnie Fox, he just died too a couple of years ago, didn't he? I think he's dead.
But who would have figured Ned Beatty would outlive Burt Reynolds?
To be honest, I don't know their ages. They could be, they all look the same age, but Burt could have been 6 to 10 years older. Who knows? It's a good question.
He's 81, so there's only a year difference.
Oh, all right. So you're right. Yeah, who would have guessed it, right? Ronnie Cox. Let's see how old. No, he's still alive too, Ronnie Cox.
Yes, he is.
Oh, so I'm mistaken. Yeah, so Bird is the first to go. Well, James Dickey actually was the sheriff, and he died. He's dead. But and Borman's dead. But they were already pretty, like 20 years older than the actors when they were there. So, but yeah, for the actors, people in front of the camera, they're all still alive except Bert. But speaking of all that, Mike, about our generation of actors that we grew up on, not the ones that are our age, but the ones that we grew up on, I kind of started feeling this way about 10 years ago or so. Once Gene Hackman retired and disappeared, that's when I said, and then Robert Duvall basically retired and disappeared. I was like, okay, all right, it's all done. So our generation of actors.
Yeah, well,
I mean, you got your schmucks now, like Robert De Niro, who's just a joke, but all the rest of them are pretty much retiring or whatever. But go on.
Well, when I had my students about 8 years ago, when I asked me when I did like as a trivia question, they said, "Who is Jack Nicholson?"
Yeah, when he disappeared, that was devastating.
Phew. But at least they're still alive. Like you just don't notice they're not making movies anymore, or in De Niro's case, you notice they still are. But it's not the same impact as when you put the exclamation mark on it that they will not be making any more movies, at least not until they get that whole virtual reality thing down a little better.
Right, right. Yeah, so that's a fair point, too. So obviously Burt Reynolds, who's he's got to be they all got to be around his age when you think about it.
Because, oh, yeah, or older.
Yeah, or older. It is crazy. Yeah. I mean, when I just look up Ronnie Cox, he's 80 years old. And I remember him just recently from RoboCop and Total Recall, for Christ's sake.
That's not recently. And he wasn't something recently where he was. Was it an episode of Dexter?
Dexter, yeah. He played,
and that was so. They, yeah, that's sure going was. Back like six or seven years, and he very obviously looked very different. His age was showing.
Yeah, sure was. But yeah, that's kind of weird that no one. Some of your students don't know who Jack Nicholson is.
Probably even fewer now. So anyway, hi, Eric.
Co-host Eric.
Co-host hi. Eric. I was on mute while you were talking about dead people.
We're basically passing a Burt Reynolds, so it was big news.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah. Yeah, so your memories of Burt Reynolds, Eric, since say you would have grown up with...
He was in movies.
Well, very well.
How sentimental he is.
I was never really a fan. Honestly, my strongest memory of Burt Reynolds is that in second grade, Janelle Lasowski and Valerie Karnisky used to chase me around the playground calling me Burt Reynolds.
That could be a good thing or a bad thing.
That would have been a good thing.
It was second grade, so it was a bad thing.
Not a lot of seven-year-olds have a mustache.
If it were to happen now, my attitude might be a little different.
Well, you know what's funny, Mike? Even though he was known with a mustache, his most famous, or well, maybe not his most famous, but his most iconic role, he had no mustache.
In Smokey and the Bandit?
No, Deliverance.
I don't know that that's his most iconic role.
Well,
it might be your personal favorite.
Yeah, yeah. It's
his personal favorite film of his that he's done. But I have a feeling if you look at all the news footage tonight when they...
I mean, really, how is Striptease not his most iconic role?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a good point, Mike. They'll probably
It will be Smokey the Bandit. That was his biggest box office.
Yeah.
That was the only movie that beat it out that year was Star Wars. You know, it spawned two sequels, neither of which was very good. But
Right. But it's No Deliverance. That was the best. Love that film. Incredible.
Again, that's the film.
Even The Simpsons played it on it.
Okay. Right. Well, that's the film that you know from the Ed Wood line. This is the one I'll be remembered for. That if they're still watching a Burt Reynolds movie in 50 years, it is likely not going to be Cannonball Run 2.
Right. Yeah. It's like Paul Schrader said in an interview I read of his, where he says no matter how many films that I've written and directed and are known for and are loved, when my obituary happens, it's going to say the author and screenwriter of Taxi Driver has passed.
Yep.
You know, so it's just how it is. You become known for something and that's it.
Hey, as long as it's good, that's fine.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There's some exceptions. Like Stephen King will be a little different. Originally, it would have said maybe one or two things, but now it'll probably say.
I was going to say he's got too much to be remembered for one.
Yeah, there is not a single iconic thing. That most they're going to do. Like if he died tomorrow.
Yeah.
They would say the author of It, right? Yes. Because that happens to be the hot thing right now. But, otherwise it's just going to be horror master Stephen King has died. And then everyone will have their list of his films or his books, and they may go chronological, they may go by sales, but yeah, there's not a single thing. But, Mark Hamill is going to be Luke Skywalker forever.
Right. Right.
Harrison Ford, it'll be a coin toss whether it's Han Solo or Indiana Jones, but I think it's going to go Indiana Jones.
He's still making the movies in 10 years.
Right. Yeah. And Sean Connery hasn't been James Bond since 1971, but,
he's James Bond.
They're never going to say Sean Connery, star of Zardoz, has died.
Roger Moore. What the hell did Roger Moore ever do besides James Bond?
The Saint.
Right.
I've never heard of it.
Right.
It was actually what got him the job. It was a TV series before.
Sean Connery's best role was Untouchables. He was awesome.
But it's not his most iconic.
Right.
But we digress.
He did get an Academy Award for it, though, I think.
Right, but it's not what he's known for.
Right, exactly. They'll say the man who brought James Bond to fame or something like that.
Right.
So, we have a topic tonight?
No.
Actually, we do have one question for you, Eric. You do another podcast with your buddy, dear?
Yeah, everybody knows about it.
Fair enough. All right, yes, we do have a topic tonight. Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
All right, tonight we're going to be discussing the new movie currently in theaters, Searching, starring John Cho.
Hey, Dad.
Hey, sweetheart. Where are you?
Study group. Gonna go all night.
Oh, one more thing. I want to know about the final you took today.
I'm Margot. I'm 15. Student.
911, what's your emergency?
I'm calling to report a missing person.
Okay, who is this regarding?
My daughter.
I'm the detective assigned to your daughter's case. I need to know how everything unfolded.
Understood.
I think we're gonna go late, all night.
One, after a study session, Margot didn't return home.
Margot Kim, school has her marked as absent today.
Two, she didn't attend school on Friday.
My daughter is in a lesson with you right now.
Margot canceled her classes 6 months ago.
And three, she's been transferring funds for the last 6 months. We'll handle the ground investigation. But as a parent, you can help us with who your daughter talks to. Is that something you can do?
Yes. Do you mind answering some questions for me to help?
Did Fear eat lunch alone?
On Thursday?
Every day.
You don't think she's involved with anything serious? I know my daughter.
We're not really that close.
She has friends, right?
Kind of.
Why did you invite her to study group?
I'm trying to get into Berkeley next year.
When was the last time you saw her?
She did not run away.
Local teen has been missing since last Thursday.
She made a transaction of $2,500. I know my daughter.
Where were you the night my daughter went missing?
I know my daughter.
Looking for her behavior also.
She gets a fake ID. I know my daughter.
This is her keychain.
She was my best friend.
You broke his jaw.
I know my daughter.
I'm trying to help you find my daughter.
I didn't know her. I didn't know my daughter.
Oh, that's right. Searching, new film, as Eric stated, starring John Cho, also Deborah Messing, mostly TV fame. I knew her face, but I've never watched anything she's been in. Directed by someone named Anish Chaganty. Don't know too much about this individual, but the main person behind the film, you could argue, is Timur Bekmambetov, who is probably best known for the Angelina Jolie film Wanted, as well as for cult film fans, the Russian vampire films Day Night Watch and Night Watch from years ago. He is of Kazakhian and Russian descent and is a citizen of both countries. John Cho, probably best known for a couple of things, actually, right? Isn't he Harold and Kumar films, but he was also in Star Trek, the reboot, right?
Right. He played Mr. Sulu. And again, his thing right now is going to be, you know, from Harold and Kumar, right? That'll be what he goes out for. And he was also in the second season of The Exorcist, which unfortunately I thought was well done. It just didn't have the ratings to survive, but you can watch it on VOD now. Had a very rather significant role in that series, also playing a father who's having child troubles, because it's The Exorcist, and that's how that works.
Right, and then Deborah Messing, I just looked her up, Will and Grace, I guess, a television show that she's most famous for.
Very famous show. I never watched it.
Oh, how about that? She went to Brandeis University right here in Massachusetts. Not right here in Massachusetts, but in the next state over, in the same town, Waltham, Massachusetts, where I went to college, Bentley. Interesting. What else? Oh, she's Jewish. Okay, no wonder why she went to Brandeis. Brandeis is a well-known Jewish college. That's all I got for this film. This was a film that I had no information on at all until I saw a post on it, I think, on Facebook or something. What about you, Eric? Let's go around and discuss. Yeah, go on, Eric.
I was just going to say, didn't we see a trailer for it before The Meg?
That's where I saw it.
Yeah.
That's how I
heard about it, too.
Yeah, so what about you, Chrissy? How did you hear about this film?
I saw a trailer for it before some other movie, and I was like, oh my gosh, that looks good. And of course, I really do like the way the story is told. Oh my gosh, forgive me, I'm so tired. I really like the way the story is told in Unfriended, and so I was kind of pleased to see that somebody else was kind of running with this idea of telling a story, or at least partially telling a story, using a computer screen, and it just looked really interesting to me. It looked like it had depth and an actual story and something that was going to be really good, so that's how I heard about it.
Right, and Mike, you heard about it the same way as me and Eric?
Yeah, AMC, I think, had a promotional deal with them somewhere because every movie I saw at AMC for like 2 months had this in front of them. And they got like an exclusive screening, I think, for the week before in limited release. I don't know if it's playing in any non-AMC theaters, but it's
it is.
It is. Okay. So, AMC was promoting the hell out of it.
Yeah, I saw it at a non-AMC theater as well. So you had already knew about this film even before me and Eric, then?
I don't know. I don't know when you first heard about it.
In front of The Meg.
Okay, then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very well. All right, so let's go around what we thought about this film and whatnot. So, Chrissy, why don't you start?
Okay. I really loved this film, and I'm definitely going to own it. This takes that method of storytelling that was established by, as I mentioned before, Unfriended, and it uses it to tell a really human universal story about grief and loss and how it affects people and relationships. But what surprised me about it was that it really had the feel of a good crime drama with a mystery at its core. And I was most impressed with the number of twists and turns and the subtle justifications for those twists and turns that felt really organic to me. I thought this story was extremely well structured. I liked the acting. I thought the reactions of the characters. I'm not doing any spoilers right now because I really believe this is one of those movies that you gotta really not spoil until we put out the spoiler warning. I really thought the characters were organic in their behaviors as well, and totally believable. And that's really in the strength not only of the acting but also of the writing. And the other thing I really liked about this film, it doesn't necessarily support the quality of the film in general, but I thought the score was really beautiful. They could have gone really techno or really horror with this, and they didn't. And as far as structure too, the number of three beats in this that were pulled off just expertly, I mean, it was just so well done. Nothing was left hanging. And I do have a question for you guys, but I guess after everybody says what they're going to say, then I'll ask my question.
All right. Very good. Mike.
Yeah. I like the film. I would say, if you're looking for expectations, this is, do these count as found footage?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
Not really. I would call them a cross.
Yeah.
Well, because with what people lump under found footage, you can go back to, say, when you had Blair Witch Project is one type that, like, a year before was the last broadcast.
What about
was another that people have lumped into there?
Cinema Verite, whatever it's called.
Cinema Verite, yeah.
I don't know if it.
I don't think it really qualifies as that.
I think this is a new subgenre. I don't know what to call it.
Right, but it's, well, just like you have within the
voyeurism.
Just as you had within the found footage, you have some things that are just like pretty straightforward, you know, unedited footage or supposedly unedited footages, and you get things that are like more faux documentary.
Right.
You know, this goes more so that's what this does. This works with the technique of going through computer screens, but it uses several different sources of screens. It's editing the footage together, so more like, say, something like The Bay. Right, unlike Unfriended.
Well, that's more of a documentary style, though, right?
Right, but I'm saying is that that's what it's doing. It's pulling from different sources, so in that regard, and it's editing different sources of footage together. It's not just...
You know what? It's similar to like the Den, maybe.
Right, so it's not just like Unfriended, where you're just sitting in front of one screen for the entire time, and all the events play out in real time. This is over the course of, like, 5 days?
That's right, about that, I think. Yeah.
And it's through different laptops, and it's sometimes through news footage and other stuff, but it's all
Mike. It's the first 10 minutes is different, but after the first 10 minutes, then it's 5 days.
Okay. Oh yeah. Right.
Yeah, he's right. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got you. I it took me a second to remember what you were talking about. Yeah, and I could take a little bit of issue with the ending, but I understand why they did what they did with the ending, and I think it was just the emotionally right thing to do for the film. And really, the whole thing centers on John Cho's performance. If he couldn't pull it off, then the film was not going to work. And I think he did a fantastic job. I do think the writing was very strong in terms of structure. And getting the emotions and playing things just enough for the audience to remember a certain plot, or at least for me to remember certain plot points, and yet not when the plot point was playing out for me to say, I know what this is going to be later on, or I know how this is going to factor in.
Right.
It's like, you forgot that there's that important point that was going to be relevant later on.
Right. So I guess you liked it a lot then, right?
I don't know that I would say I liked it a lot, but I did like it. I don't know if I'll end up owning it or ever watching it again, but I liked it, and I would say right now, if you're looking for something to watch in theaters, it's one to go see. I would certainly recommend it over Slenderman, or probably The Meg. But yeah, I think it's a safer film than either of those.
Now, Mike, did Pam see it?
Yes.
And what did she think?
She had more of a problem with the ending than I did.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Well, but again, I don't think it's an unfair point.
It's not.
Otherwise, she really liked the first two-thirds of it.
All right. And this was
the film that she was hoping we were going to be doing when we did our Mystic Meetup.
We were all hoping that. The studio screwed us.
Yeah,
it screwed us twice, because it was supposed to be Slenderman, and then it was supposed to be Searching, and then we had to do Meg, which is not a problem. It's just that half of us had already seen the movie, and we were all hoping to go in blind.
And some people went to see Meg when we already had decided we were not going to see Meg, but that's okay.
Well, I just thought, when I was sitting there watching this film, I was like, this would have been really fun to see with the guys in Mystic.
Yeah, it would have been, and that was
it
the plan.
It really would have been, yeah, oh well. But whatever. The best laid plans of mice and men, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So, anyhow.
Now, Mike, what would you qualify this film as a genre? Is it a horror? Is it a thriller? Is it a combination of both? Is it a psychological thriller?
Why you got to label it, Phil? Can't you just love it?
Because I'm just curious, because
That was actually my question. I mean, not to interrupt, and I don't want to get too far off topic, but I felt that this film, how did you guys feel it was marketed in you guys' opinion? Because to me, I thought it was really going to be much darker. I mean, it's dark, but it's emotionally dark. And it felt like a crime drama. It did not feel like a horror film. And a lot of people that, when I was done seeing this movie, I thought of about six of my friends right off the bat, where I was like, oh my God, they love good crime dramas like I do. We all watch murder porn on ID Discovery or whatever it is. I'm like, they're all going to love this, because that's the kind of ilk that they like, this kind of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had trouble convincing them, no, it's not a horror film. It's not. It's a crime drama. You'll love it. Because of the way the commercials were structured, the trailers were structured. So I was wondering what you guys thought about it.
It is definitely a mystery thriller type. And, you know, you have to remember, like, detective stories were, I guess, they credit to Edgar Allan Poe for creating. And so it's kind of a branch off of the horror novel. You know, there is a lot related to it. And if you think about the earliest true crime stories that people probably told, they weren't telling the true crime stories about the person who shoplifted from Kmart. You know, those were like the stories of people like Jack the Ripper, you know, and Bluebeard and stuff like that. So they would always be the more horrific crimes. So I think there is, just in general, an overlap between some of the crime dramas and mystery films and detective stories and good horror stories. Doesn't mean that, I'm not saying they're equal, but you know, if you look at the Venn diagram, you'll see a lot of common area. But I don't know. The marketing, I looked at it, I think part of the fact is that it's obvious that this is a whatever found footage techno voyeur film or whatever you want to call that. And really, there's very few films that do that are not horror films, right? I mean, I can think of End of Watch. You know, uses that camera point of view, you know, perspective kind of thing, but I can't think of any others that are outside the genre that do that.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, no, it's got a bit of a lot of stuff in it. So
I never thought of it as a horror movie, not even from the trailer.
Not as a straight up horror film, though.
No.
Right. Yeah, not as a straight up. All right. So Eric, what's your opinion? Yeah.
I agree with a lot of what's been said already. I really enjoy the way they did the computer stuff in this movie. I think it was superior to the Unfriended films. I also liked it because it was a little more, I mean, I had an issue with the ending too. It kind of goes into La La Land a little bit, but I think this is a more grounded story than either of the Unfriended movies, which makes it a little easier to roll with. John Cho was great in this movie. I was listening to the Slash Filmcast about this movie earlier today, and they were talking about how John Cho initially did not want to do this movie because they told him what it was and how it was going to be done, and he was just like, that can't be interesting. And then I guess the director did a sales pitch and really walked him through exactly how he planned to do it. And he was like, oh, well, okay, that has a chance of being okay. And that's how he talked him into it. So good job for the director, because Cho really carries it. And I thought he was fantastic in this movie. So, this is a recommend for me.
All right, very good. For me, first off, John Cho saying that he didn't want to do the film is just insane, because here's a perfect opportunity, as we all stated here, to be the showpiece or the star of a limited cast film that will be released. I'm assuming this wasn't picked up at a festival and then released by a big company, but maybe it was.
It may have been. It had like Sundance things splashed all over the trailer.
Yeah, this doesn't seem like a big budget film that was guaranteed to be, you know, getting a wide theatrical release. So
then I could see Cho maybe not being interested in it. But either way, the outcome was fantastic. As Eric mentioned, John Cho was absolutely fantastic in this film. And as you said, Mike, he's definitely the guy that has to hold the film together for it to work. Not that other actors couldn't, but he was obviously perfectly cast, because he sure did. The ending, it doesn't fit with the rest of the film. I mean, the rest of the film, the mystery and thrills are so awesome that once you hit the ending, it kind of poo-poos a bit and fades out a bit and whatever. So that's
I would describe it as jarringly cheesy.
Yeah, it was somewhat of that as well. I would go with you, Eric.
I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll get into it, but I kind of got a different message out of this film than the one that the director said. So
that,
you know,
we'll finish.
Yeah,
okay. I'm sorry. That's my fault. I interrupted first.
Sorry.
That's right. I was just going to wrap up, which is. Even with all that stated, this film is awesome. I enjoyed it completely. I could have it on a top Dark Discussions list wherever we decide to put it at the end of the year somewhere. Top 10, top 20, on one of the two lists, whether it's the horror list or the speculative list.
Which I think it's probably more the other list, would be my guess.
Yeah, you could be right. All in all, I would highly recommend the film. I actually told my wife that when it comes out on VOD or disc, she'll want to see it, because it's the type of film that she would even enjoy too. So
I really want to listen to a commentary on this movie.
Yeah. It'll be good to hear such a thing, especially from John Cho, even more so probably than the filmmakers, to be honest, because he is this film, really. I love this film. It's a great film. All right, so before we go into what Chrissy was about to talk to, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki. All right, on IMDb it says, after his 16-year-old daughter goes missing, a desperate father breaks into her laptop to look for clues to find her.
All right, very good. Yeah, that's pretty good.
I like that. It's brief, to the point, accurate, not misleading.
Yep. Absolutely.
But it doesn't tell you everything either.
No, it doesn't even tell you how the film was made. I mean, I pretty much went into it blind, except for the Meg trailer that happened. And even then, I wasn't expecting it to be all technology perspective. So I was kind of surprised. And I had no idea really what the film was about. We'll throw up that spoiler alert right now, just for
so we can talk about some stuff.
Yeah, because I know Chrissy wants to talk about the ending and whatnot.
Before we talk about the ending, let's talk about the beginning.
Yeah, I was almost in tears.
I was seriously.
Dude, I bawled.
This reminded me of the beginning of the movie Up. Did you see the movie Up?
That's exactly where I was going to go.
Where there's nothing, there's no spoken dialogue, you're just watching images, and The way they portray this, you just get this story told to you. It's basically they took 10 minutes of showing different stuff happening on a computer screen to save the actors from delivering a whole shit ton of awful cheesy dialogue for exposition. And they also did it artfully enough that they really get the story of this loving family where the mom gets cancer and goes into remission, but then it comes back and she ends up dying, and it kind of breaks the father and daughter. And they portray all of this to you wordlessly on computer screens in the first 10 minutes of the movie. And by the time they got to, but they caught up to current day, I was leaking. I had tears coming down my cheeks.
Well, I'm kind of glad to hear that you guys were moved by that, because of, you know, I lost my mom to cancer when I would have been Margot's age. So I was a mess in the first 10 minutes of this movie. And I just sat there and watched that montage and thought, this is genius. It's geniusly structured, yet it tugs at your heartstrings, you know, even if you didn't have that kind of experience, because it is so well done. And I completely understood. And at the, I'll tell you what the saddest thing was the last photograph where you see just the dad and Margot, and they're just kind of smiling half-heartedly for her first day of school. And that was the thing that really hammered it home. I thought it was very believable and it's real. I mean, I can't even tell you how many pictures I have of my family like that. But it was just so well done. And also, like you said, they saved us from a lot of
exposition.
Thank you. But also, you understand where Margot is when this story opens, so that when she starts going downhill or starts doing weird things, it's not necessarily, I mean, it's bizarre, but it's not, because you're like, oh, well, this, you know, this, but you know what I mean? It was like bizarre that she would, you know, not pay for piano lessons and all this, but because we had all that backstory, it kind of wasn't. Like, we sort of get this picture of this family in grief. But
you know what? We've heard, it's exactly what you said, Chrissy, because we've heard plenty of times, or we've seen our friends, or even we may have done it ourselves, done things like that where we're telling our parents we're doing something and we're really skipping out, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And so I could see her actually doing that, you know, skipping out on piano lessons and just pocketing the money for whatever reason. And we'll find out the reason, you know, as we discuss the film. But it makes sense, you know, in her, and we, that we see through her videos, even, you know, whether her mother passed or not, is similar to most people's, and we that aren't, you know, the most popular person in school either, you know, so it makes sense in a lot of ways. Sorry to interrupt you, Chrissy.
No, that's okay. I've been interrupting all night so far, so whatever.
No, what I really liked was effective for me in getting the feels up was as you're watching them change the calendar, right? The mom, you know, whatever, September 1st, mom coming home, then it got moved to like September 30th.
Oh yeah,
because you get the you can identify with that. You know, we all use you know, like the Google Calendar or whatever it may be. And at the same time, you can feel like, oh, you know, the hope, you know, of coming home, and then, you know, the realization of having to move it. You get that sort of, you know, the disappointment, you identify with it. And then when it's just removed altogether, you nobody has to tell you, you know, as you said, we don't need the exposition to tell us what's going on. We all get it.
And I have to say, before all the sad stuff started, the opening shot of the movie of just the default background from Windows XP. Everybody in my theater thought I was a freak because I literally laughed out loud.
I was like, oh my God, it's my father's home screen.
I was like, either this is a period piece or this is a seriously ancient computer they're using.
Right.
We get the timeline that Margot was a little girl, so it was.
It all makes sense eventually.
Well, but it's supposed to. I mean, that's
with it.
That's like when you watch something in Kodachrome, right? It's like, you know, it's taking you back to a certain time.
they're real
8mm films, right? It's so that's a way of telling you that this is set before.
Right.
Seeing that background was so unexpected, it just elicited a laugh from me.
Right, like every, you know, film that is a period piece that's made today, they always have the person holding a Schlitz can, you know, because that was the popular beer in the 70s and 80s, you know. So this is a way to do it. So they're being authentic, which was cool, because, like, you immediately noticed it, Eric, while, you know, Abe probably wouldn't have got it at all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, go ahead, Christian.
But I would say that in general, though, with that opening montage and they cram in all that exposition, throughout the film, they do really well with nuanced storytelling.
Oh, absolutely.
That they really do, where they tell us, as the audience, things, but they don't spell it out. Like, one of my favorite moments was when
they do spell it out.
Well, they do, but here's one example of not spelling it out. You actually have to think. You get a lot if you put it together. For example, when David logs onto the old computer the family used, and a message pops up that says, "You have not run Norton antivirus in 694 days.
Yeah.
And that kind of tells the audience
almost 2 years since she died.
Yep, and it also says that they can't bear to look at might be what on that computer.
Mm-hmm.
And it also makes a comment how on people, when they lose someone close to them, they memorialize or freeze time. So they're leaving the computer the way she left it. That's how devastated they are. So we get information about Margot and David. We get information about how much time has passed. And we get information on the fact that they're just, you know, their condition, their emotional condition. And all of that was just in that one little pop-up message. And I just thought it was little stuff like that. They also did it when he beat up the kid. They did the same thing. They only show you a piece of it. Yes, Detective Vic explains it afterward, but that allowed that dialogue to be a lot more natural.
No, the production, the production value on this movie is amazing. The amount of work they put into everything. And I also enjoyed the fact that for the most part, and there's one thing they made up, but for the most part, they're using actual stuff that exists in the real world. You know, they're using Windows, they're using Mac OS, they're using FaceTime, and texting and doing all that. The UCAS was really the only thing they made up. So I appreciated that. And also, you were talking about not spelling it out. Sometimes they did spell it out, and I kind of enjoyed that because all you see for this whole movie is the screen, and they showed him, just like we all do sometimes, starting to type something to somebody, and then stopping and going, maybe that's not the best approach, deleting it, and then typing something else.
Yeah, it reminds me, there was a meme I saw right before watching this, where it said, like, you know, when, you know your girlfriend's mad at you, and you just see the text bubble, but no messages coming through, you know. It's just
right.
So you know, she just.
Oh God, it's coming! It's coming!
Oh yeah. So yeah, it's that same thing. We've all kind of been there, and you know, it's the how do you phrase it? And they use that a lot, though, also in Unfriended, right? Which is the, you know, trying to find the right way to say it, so it's a way of portraying the character's thoughts, you know, and stuff like the Norton. It's nice to not have to deal with that. Wow, I can't believe it's been 2 years since Mom died.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right. Those are brilliant ways to present us information without having to do stupid exposition, because those things do happen where, you know, Norton's bubble will pop up and people do type things and then they delete it before they press return. So,
well, I think one of the coolest things that he erased, because it was actually David's character arc, was when he typed, "Mom would be proud of you," and then he erased it. And then at the end of the movie, he erases something else and instead types, "Mom would be proud of you." Mm-hmm. So that's his arc, in that he has accepted the grief. He has accepted that his wife is gone, and he's accepted to move on, you know, with his life, with his daughter.
And I think
that was really well done.
And I think the stronger point in that particular message is that earlier in the movie, you see him type that and delete it and not send it. So he has realized that in order to heal, they need to talk about it instead of avoid it.
Right.
If I could just go with what Eric just said, Mike, which was there's a scene where he goes in to her bedroom to talk to her about the anniversary of the death.
Oh, my God. That was an awesome scene.
And then he changes. You could tell that he was going to do it. And then he changes and he says, American Idol's on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so
the voice.
That shows. Oh, the voice. You're right. Yeah, and so it shows that he could not, you know, accept it or talk about it himself, and he avoids it when you know she probably wants to talk about it. You know, so it shows that there's a problem where they're not talking about
their feelings, their grief. Yeah.
And I think she wants to talk about it, meaning the daughter, but she's, you know, can't do it herself. She needs the adult, the person she looks up to talk about it, and he can't do it. Now, Mike, you were going to say something.
So, yeah, it's interesting. There's, you know, because I have to see some of this research for work and stuff, but it's like there are a lot of times there are issues with kids that are coming from single-parent homes or broken homes, but you don't actually usually get that same thing from the kids when it's because a parent died, because that tends to create a bonding effect with them. You know, I'm not saying it's a good thing the parent dies, but it's sort of that memory carries them through, and you don't get that same sort of issues. You know, but it does take time to work it through, but you see that this is an issue that they're holding up mom's memory, right? And that whole do it for mom, you know, and all of that's kind of still sort of there. She's still doing the lessons or had been doing the lessons because, well, it's what mom would have wanted. But it's creating an issue that's there for, you know, between the mother and the child. And the mother is still there as a character, even though she's not there in the film anymore.
Well, and that was also interesting because when she wasn't doing the piano lessons anymore, my immediate reaction, which is told to the audience later, is, oh, she stopped doing the lessons because it's too painful. It reminds her of her mom. Like, that to me was obvious. I don't even know why. Well, I guess they really did. The two brothers needed to have it out, obviously, so.
Yeah, there's been a lot of red herrings, for sure.
Oh, yeah, and that one with the brother in particular.
Oh, my God, that was so great.
I thought that movie was about to go dark. I was like, oh, no, where are we going with this? But it was just, so it's all good.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking the same thing, Eric. Incest, rape. I was like, oh my God.
Well, obviously, terrible. I think they wanted us to go there because
absolutely.
The phrasings of the messages, it was very specifically like, written in a way to make you think it wouldn't be weed.
Oh, right.
Do you know what I mean? It was like, oh my God, what are they doing? Like, you know,
I'll see you tonight, and I can't wait to do it. You know,
I seriously thought they were having a sexual relationship. I was just like, oh no.
Yeah, it was intentional, as you said, Eric, that it was written a certain way that we, the audience, would think it's one thing, but when it explained away, it makes sense that, oh, okay, it makes sense now, yeah.
Right, and it didn't feel like, you know, this was a good example I was talking about before. When you see the original conversation with the brother, and he says, you know, is that weed? And he's, oops, and he hides it. It doesn't feel like it's anything other than something to give you a little character moment between the two of them. It doesn't feel like, you know, hey, is that an important plot point sitting on your counter right there?
And there are a few of those little things in the movie, too, like when he goes back onto mom's computer. First of all, mom's got her shit together because she's got, like, all those contacts for every friend her kids ever had.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
Well, she is what they would call a tiger mom.
Yeah, and one of them, you think back on it, you don't realize it at the time when you're staring at it, but when he opens one of them, it's the detective's fucking kid. I'm willing to bet that if you were paying really close attention and remembered that last name, you would have put two and two together when you heard the detective's last name. But I certainly wasn't, you know, memorizing the names as they came up. But I bet, I'm going to watch this again when it comes out on video. And I'm willing to bet that the people that made this movie paid enough attention to detail that, damn it, that last name is going to match.
Now, How did you figure it out, Eric? Did you read about it after, or it just
no? I remember one of the cards that he pulled up said, "So and so, a friend since they were five has big crush on her."
This makes sense because, as we discussed, Unfriended: The Dark Web came out a month or two earlier. The guy that produced this film, he produced that film as well, and so it makes sense that he's very much into detail to make sure these films work. And since he has experience making these films before, he's just getting better and better if he keeps on making films like this. And Searching is his latest.
And I'm gonna keep an eye out for you, but I have faith that these people did it right. And when I go back and look at it, that last name is gonna be the detective's last name.
Well, and yeah. Also all of the twists and turns that we get toward the end, because of that same organic thing that you mentioned, Eric, where all of these little clues pop up in the movie, but they just seem like very normal.
Right.
And then you don't really realize, oh, my God, until the end. That's justified. I mean, all those twists and turns were totally justified. You sat there and you went, oh, my God. You know, and that's sometimes what I'm always talking about when I'm saying they didn't give us an earned ending or whatever.
Right.
All of this was earned. All of this was earned.
Right. And there's – but Pam had complained. She said it felt like the ending was tacked on. And I didn't get that. I understand, like, the disappointment in how it ends up and in the ending. But everything that's there in the way the ending plays out
–
It's all laid out. So this isn't, like, one of those things where the ending just is a – it's clearly they had a reshot ending – and correct. There's nothing built up for that. It's all with it. Now, you may not like where it goes, but where it goes from is there from the beginning of the story. But what I like about all these little, you know, red herrings is that, you know, because you have this, you know, this voyeur attitude, you know, thing of watching all this play out, you're watching him do the research. You're watching him do the sleuthing. And the reality is most of that shit would be dead ends.
Right,
you know,
right.
99% of the kids that you would talk to wouldn't know a goddamn thing about what's going on with her, you know, and her.
There was one woman in particular, and I'm sure that they did this on purpose so I would react this way, but it worked, which is that towards the end of the movie when he's on the online memorial website and that picture comes up with the stock art model. Like,
yeah.
I in my head was reacting before Sean Cho did on screen. I'm sitting there screaming in my head, it's fish and chips! It's fish and chips! God damn it, look at the picture! It's fish and chips!
And I like that they didn't even use that. They didn't use this that exact photo, right? That they just
right,
yeah,
right.
Go ahead.
So they picked a model who you could believe is a model.
Yeah.
And yet who is distinctive enough that you recognized her, you know, out of context.
Uh-huh.
Well, and the other thing that was cool, too, was the moment where he's like, where have I, you know, you and you're just shown this through the screen. But he's like, where have I seen this face? And uh-huh. First he goes to Facebook and then he goes to Tumblr. Like, he doesn't just jump right to, oh,
right.
It was fish and chips on UCAST. Like, we see him take a few minutes to figure it out. But I was doing the same thing you were doing, Eric. I was screaming, I knew that fish and chips was nothing but trouble. The second that fish and chips thing showed up, I was like, that's it. That's the person who did it. And I got the sense that fish and chips was probably a guy, even though it had the model face.
And here's the thing. I like the red herring of fish and chips because I also knew that that was going to be the culprit. But they really did a good job of laying out that whole storyline about a waitress in Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah.
Because when that starts to unravel, you're like, wait, what's going on?
Well, again, and that's because that naturalistic sort of running into dead ends, because then we get the thing with the brother, and that turns out to be a dead end.
That's what I was going to say, too, Mike, yeah. So basically what it is, it's the first red herring, or so seems, and it runs into a dead end. And then we have the brother, and it runs into and it just, that's what I meant, where it just the mystery and the throw up aspect is like, who did it? And they keep on ruling people out, which is great, because usually in a thriller or a mystery, you know, you're only introduced to about, you know, maybe 10 characters, so you know one of the 10 characters is the bad person, unless they do ex machina which sometimes they do. So for them to keep on ruling people out and introducing people and ruling them out, I felt was really effective. And then even when they do bring fish and chips back, we find out why, because of that picture, as you said, Eric, and then we find out it's just a fake model, and that model has nothing to do with it. And then we find out the real twist of the film, and we now know why fish and chips was ruled out, because fish and chips didn't exist at all, and the person that ruled fish and chips out was just lying.
Yep.
But you're right. I mean, I originally thought it was fish and chips too, but when they ruled fish and chips out originally, I was like, okay, let's move on, because then the brother came into effect. And then when the brother was ruled out, then I'm thinking, ooh, this is interesting. And I think they were doing what Mike said, which is all the loose ends, or dead ends, I should say. So,
well, and I'd like to make also a comment on one of the parts of the movie that I really got a charge out of was, you know, we see David Cho in the beginning, and he's interviewing all of these people. And we kind of figure out that she really doesn't have many friends, and that she's not the popular person that he maybe thought his daughter was. But it's really a big comment here on the viral nature of technology, because then later in the film, after she's missing and it becomes this big, you know, everybody's looking for her, and we see this whole montage where everyone jumps on this bandwagon.
She was my best friend
when the same girl 2 hours, you know, earlier in the film was going, I don't know, I just needed her to get into Barclay or whatever the hell.
Yeah, we weren't really friends at all, you know.
And then they have all these praying for Margot hashtags and all this stuff. And it was just kind of an interesting comment on, like, everybody wants a piece of internet fame, and they don't really care how they do it. Like, I don't know. I thought that.
Well, that's part of it. And, you know, I've been in a situation where we've had kids die in the school, and you will get kids react to that, you know, we're not like their friends or not. Some kids just really do react emotionally to that.
But this one example in this movie, though, the girl completely lied when she was interviewed.
Well, or misrepresented, you know, the story. The kid, sometimes it's genuine, sometimes it's not. Some kids are delusional when it comes to that.
This film, though, was most certainly done to show us that this girl was lying.
Or she was exploiting it.
Yeah, exploiting.
But a girl like that can convince herself, you know, because she was a friend with her, you know, and they were closer friends at one point, so she can now go back and focus on those memories as opposed to the memories of, I didn't really give a shit about her for the last 2 years.
No, that girl wasn't never really close to her. It was the boy that was good friends with her back in the elementary, and then that story wrapped up where, oh, well, my mom, you know, moms, they're still friends with, and whatever, and so she told me to invite her, whatever. This girl just needed her for study group.
Right. Oh, that's right. Right. Okay.
So, I mean, obviously it's trying to, I like your word though, that people exploit a situation, to feel important or feel like they're contributing somehow or whatever. With all the missing Margot hashtags and find Margot hashtags and whatever. So it is interesting, but I don't know what I could do except either, like you said, Mike, some people are legitimate, but also there's the hanger-ons and whatever that you were talking about, Chrissy, which is kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about the cop, because
that's what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, when she was introduced, I was thinking the same thing, which is, who is this? I mean, I don't believe it. And then when he was smart enough to look on YouTube and all these places and get a picture of her and find out that she's a real cop, then I was on board. Because
why didn't you believe it?
I don't know. I was thinking that there was going to be impersonation, and then the film really went into it, a true investigation. But at the very beginning when she was introduced, where someone was assigned to the case, I was thinking that there was something fishy. But then when he did the YouTube things, I said, okay. I don't know. You know what it is? Probably because I've seen enough mystery films where people pretend they're a reporter or a cop or something, and then you find out at the end they're the actual murderer or something. And I was thinking that's where it was going to go.
No, I was thinking he was just checking to see if she was any good or not. Like, did they get him and somebody who's good at her job, or was it that they just dump him off on...
Okay. So, yeah, so you were looking at it like how, I guess you were supposed to look at it. I was looking at it because I just read a Joe Lansdowne book where the reporter actually was the murderer, and I was like, holy shit. So, but go on, Eric and Chrissy.
Well, here's what I was going to say. I understand that parents love their children, would do anything for them, but really? You're gonna frame an ex-con and murder him to protect your child?
Yeah,
not only extreme.
Not only an ex-con, but an ex-con who turned their life around.
Right.
Well, you know what? I remember somewhere at some point in my life, someone said something really significant and wise, and that was that people suck.
extreme.
I did have a little bit of a problem. I mean, that was set up in the beginning. When he's looking at the photos, we see that photo initially with the ex-con that she's going to frame. So again, just like in the rest of this movie, everything is already set up for you. And I think that's why you said, Eric, I'm going to buy it and watch it again. So am I, because now that I know how it all comes out, I really want to study where all these little clues are, because it was just really well done. But I was thinking, sitting here going, how would she have convinced that guy to do that? But they mentioned something about drugging him. Did you guys pick up on that?
No.
They said I could.
I don't remember what they did. They did say how she convinced him to do it, but I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, it said something. I swear it was something about you drugged him up or something. When they were in the interrogation room at the end, and they said you drugged him up so that he would do this. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't. But I'm not. Now that I'm thinking about it, I'm not sure that that's what I really heard. But because that was the one point in this movie that I was kind of like, huh, I don't know that this works. However, I will say that, you know, obviously she says her son is different. Her son is special, meaning he's got, you know, issues of some kind. And so therefore
I was interpreting it as he's somewhere on the spectrum.
Right.
That's kind of the way I interpreted it, too. But, you know, sometimes those parents can be very overprotective, and over time it can drive them mad. That was just how I kind of took it. I was like, okay, well, she finally went insane, like, especially since it's clear that her son is her entire life, not necessarily her job. Like, it's her son that's her whole life. So the thought of losing her son is losing her identity.
But
so
I think
she's going to do anything to protect that.
There's a parallel here between the mother, between the cop and John Cho's character, because they're both single parents with the child. And in both cases, the child is kind of the center of their world in a lot of ways. Yes, it's an extreme reaction, Eric, but, you know, if you go into prisons, you'll find an awful lot of people who have unreasonable reactions to things that happen in their life.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, she also left that girl to die.
Yep.
It's like, well, I understand your son's in trouble, but shouldn't she just look for her first?
Well, wait a minute, but did she leave her to die, or did she think she was already dead?
She assumed she was dead without going to find her.
Right, and that's, yeah.
And then she prevented the police from searching where she knew she was.
Well, yeah, to throw him off the track. And that was, yeah, this is the problem with any kind of, but a lot of these kind of mysteries, that you have to come up with the ending that is not the really obvious ending, even though in real life it's almost always the obvious person is the one that did it.
Right.
So in this case, you know, they have to sometimes find something convoluted you know, and something that plays into the whole conspiracy theory mindset that some people then believe is how real life works. You know, it's never OJ. It's always, you know, no, OJ just did it. No, it's, you know, it was the Bushes. I don't know what it is. You know, something weird happened. Barbara Bush murdered OJ Simpson's wife, you know, and yeah, it's just stupid shit like that. And but otherwise the story's over in 5 minutes, right? You know, they and that means that you do oftentimes stretch credulity, you know, and yeah, I think it just kind of goes with it, and sometimes this stretches it maybe more than necessary. But you know, I'm willing to roll with it.
Yeah, let's talk what happened. So basically, his daughter is it high school or is
yes.
it college?
High school, yes.
It is
high
okay. school. So
she's taking AP classes, but she's taking like I think she does a sophomore, so she's definitely an accelerated student.
Okay.
Well, and I think she's 15 when her mom dies. Something right. tells so, me so, she's so, 15.
All right, so then she's 17 or 18.
And she can drive.
Yeah, so the film is 17 or 18. She's 17 or 18 then at the point when the movie goes into full gear, basically. Because we flash forward, obviously, after the death of the mother to the present day. The girl... is it high school or whatever? The father is FaceTimes her, complains that she didn't take out the garbage, and then that's how it begins. Then we see it's the middle of the night. She's gone to study class, and it's at the middle of the night, and he gets three phone calls, two calls and one FaceTime, or two FaceTimes and one phone call. But obviously, it's you know 1 a.m. or whatever. He doesn't get the answer. And then a couple of days go by one day goes by and then she's reported as missing, basically. And that's pretty much how the film begins, right? I mean, that's the setup, the whole setup, mm-hmm. I guess. And then he begins to go into, I guess he decides that she's missing when he notices her computer. She didn't take it with her to school, and then he goes into her computer and his wife's deceased wife.
Well, she's not responding to texts. It escalates, right? Is that there's always something that puts it off, right? So first he thinks you know she's not responding. He thinks she's being irresponsible because she just like forgot to take out the garbage.
Oh, then he thinks she went on a trip, right, without telling
him? Right, he calls the piano teacher, and she's not at the piano, and he's like, oh, right, it's Friday, she's at piano lessons. Well, no, it turns out, or was it Thursday or Friday? Whatever, she's not at the piano lesson, and that's how he finds out that she hasn't been taking piano lessons for months. Right. And then he starts trying to track down the friends, and he finds out, oh, well, the one friend is off at a camping trip, so that's where she must be, and that's why she hasn't responded to me. But then the kid comes back the next day and she's not there, and that's when he knows for sure that she's a missing person. Of course, we all know what movie we paid for, and the name of the movie is Searching, and so we knew she was missing right away.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So we're already 2 days late that she's been missing, and we don't even, or at least we know, but he doesn't know until 2 days later when the boy and his friends come back from the camping trip, and he says that she never showed up, even though she was invited.
Well, and I did think that the spooling out of him going from she's irresponsible to, oh, what's going on, to, oh, my God, she's missing, was handled very well and very tightly, and it could have slowed down the pacing, and instead they filled it with tension. And I'm still not quite sure how they pulled that off, but you were on the edge of your seat, even though you knew she was missing.
Right.
So that essentially could have been extremely boring in there because we're waiting for the father to just figure it out. But it was the way they told the story and the way they led him down all these different paths that you were entangled with him in what he was trying. You were actually walking with him And so therefore you didn't get bored because we already knew the answer. And I thought that was so well handled. A lesser movie, I don't think would have pulled it off as well. Because I was full of tension. I knew this girl was missing, and yet I was like, oh my God, well maybe she is at piano. You know, I was totally sucked in. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that because I thought that was another place this movie excelled.
Well, and I also thought that the setup to what am I trying to say here? At one point, you're led to believe that she has created a fake identity for herself and run away. You find out eventually that that is not true, but I found that possibility very intriguing and kind of wish it would have gone that way because you can't really understand why. I mean, it's not like her dad beats her or anything like that. You can't quite figure out why she would have taken off like that. So I was a little bit intrigued by that aspect, but it turns out to be a red herring.
Yes, that's true. Well, that's another thing that's good about this movie is that the mystery, I mean, all the red herrings are feasible and work. You know, everything that happens like it should, where, you know, dead ends, as Mike put up, finding things about the daughter that he didn't know, you know, the clueless father type thing. And all in all, it was what kept my interest throughout, because it's like, what's going to happen? Is she dead? I mean, I just assumed that she was going to be dead, you know, and then there's the big twist that, you know, that wraps it up that she's okay, but, well, not okay, but it probably will never be 100% okay, but at least survive. So, I mean, I don't know where I was going with that, but I just felt like adding to what you were saying there, Eric, which is what kept this film as a top-notch film in my book.
Yeah. I mean, I had issues with the ending. I thought it was... I like dark stuff, so I was kind of bummed that it had a happy ending. Because just having the detective get busted and thrown in jail would have been a happy enough ending for me. The fact that, oh, wait, she's alive because it rained and she got water and let's go find her. I was just like, oh, come on. But
yeah, and it was a good three-beat, though. I mean, the drought thing was a good three-beat because we did see it on his computer screen in the beginning. And then there was the second mention where the rain called off the search.
Mm-hmm.
And then at least it was justified. I'm kind of with you guys. I was a little disappointed that she lived.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'm disappointed. I don't know that you do a movie like this where you are following the father that intimately throughout the entire process, right? And they go through that whole thing in the beginning with the story with the mother. And this is a film that's built on heartbreak to begin with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know...
Eric,
I don't know that people other than Eric, you know, are going to be that very satisfied walking out of there with a final just, hi, this is a bleak, depressing movie, and it's going to get bleaker and depressinger, you know, as we go.
Yeah.
I would have been okay with that, but that's like Eric. I mean, I don't know. I love things that are heartbreakingly sad and tragic. Right, I just do, because it's what I understand. It's what I relate to. I get it. But the general public probably would have been pissed, but I would have been all over it.
Even better, awesome. even better, John Cho fucking murders the detective and goes to jail.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
The entire family is destroyed. Awesome.
Like, yeah. It's one of these things where, you know, with finding the daughter alive... you know, in real life, it's unlikely to happen, but I've seen stranger things where someone managed to make it. You know, you have, what was the movie with John Franco, 128
Hours? 127
Hours. 127 Hours. All right, 128 Hours is the
sequel. Come on, like Mike. 128 is just unbelievable.
Yes. You know, so I'm willing to accept it. It's again, it's unlikely, but not impossible or even implausible. And it began because it's also kind of built in. If they'd said she survived for 5 days without water, I'd be more like, kind of bullshit. You know, but right, there are stories of people like that that have survived. You know, it's the whole conspiracy plan of what she did to cover up with the son, when it really was just an accident, right? He didn't really do anything to her,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right. I mean, assuming people would believe her story, right? I mean, she survived, so she could tell half her story, but...
Well, I mean, it's sort of the... what was the guy's name down in Florida? The George Zimmerman, right? I mean, when you only have two witnesses to a story and one of them is dead, it's right. really hard to dispute the story of the survivor, even if they're the accused, the one who supposedly did it.
Right.
You know, and that's the problem. So, and as a cop, she should have recognized that if the girl was actually dead,
yeah.
you know, then he would have had a much, you know, the alibi, you know, and any number of stories that she could have helped him concoct. You know, there were probably easier and cleaner ways to do it, but people are not always rational, and especially not going to be rational when you're trying to protect, you know, your child. They're not going to in a high stress situation like that. But yeah, so I like I said, it's sort of I think of listening back to the commentary track with Sinister, you know, where they talked about, you know, they have that ending where like there's the one last bagul at the end,
uh-huh.
and they said that it was weird that even though the movie didn't change, 99% of the film didn't change, audiences without the final bagul were walking out unsatisfied and giving them
really
worse, and were walking out and giving the movie bad scores. Where you got the, I understand that, but you got the bagul and suddenly they got better scores. Sometimes, you know, it's just, you know, it's
spoiler,
but you're, well, no, it's just a bagul, it's a boo, a final boo, you know, you get in the final thing in the film. And, you know, and that's sometimes audiences need to have that sort of positive moment, even if it's a scare, to come out. It's not, you know, it, and yeah, sometimes you will get a film like Seven where, you know, it's just kick you in the nuts as much as you possibly can. But those are relative. It's rare that those films end up being popular with audiences.
I just got a mental image of Morgan Freeman kicking Brad Pitt in the nuts repeatedly, and it was very amusing.
What's in the box? Whack! What's in the box? Whack!
Or kicking the head around.
Yeah.
Oh.
I didn't mind, because we were talking about the ending earlier at the beginning. It didn't bug me, I don't think, that much. I was kind of bummed because I wanted a full-on Romeo and Juliet-esque tragedy. That's just how the movie kind of sets you up. I mean, if you look at that really tear-jerking emotional beginning, it almost sets you up for, you know, knowing that this is not going to be a happy ending. Which now, then, of course, they twisted on you, but still, Phil, it didn't bother me that much.
Phil mentioned something to me in a text message that I did notice, and it's like one of the few things in the movie that, to me, is not explained properly. And that is that when he's doing his computer research and looking through all of his daughter's social media, he finds a picture of her that's kind of got a close-up of her neck area, and it looks like she's got a rope mark around her neck, like she tried to hang herself. Did anybody else catch that?
Yeah, me.
I did.
Well, I mean, besides you, Phil.
No,
you did?
I did, Eric.
Okay.
You didn't see it, Mike?
No, I don't remember seeing it.
Okay.
I thought they were specifically focusing on it to show us that, like, hey, look at this.
Yeah, it's
important, and then it never came back into play.
Right, exactly.
Well, here's the thing. It didn't exactly come back into play, but to be honest with you, I don't think it necessarily needed to, because what they were trying to show here, like they did with a couple of other things that she said and did in her videos, they were trying to show that she was you know, truly desperate and really, you know, grieving to the point where she didn't want to do this anymore. One of the areas where that was echoed was in the Pokemon, you know, where the kid asks her, or Fish and Chips asks her, what's your favorite Pokemon? And she says Uxie. And when he asks why, she says, it's because it erases memories. And it's interesting.
Oh, I missed that.
Okay, yeah, excellent. And it's interesting that this Pokemon is the one chosen out of all these Pokemons, right? There's like, I don't know, thousands of Pokemons, I don't know. But it tells us right there that Margot is in that much pain, that emotionally, that she doesn't want to remember her mother at all. Like, and so therefore, between that and the piano lessons and the mark on the neck, I was cool. I thought that was enough. I got it.
But the mark on the neck not being answered is bizarre, because does that mean she tried to suicide? Does that mean that she was assaulted? I mean, we don't know, and it's never answered.
No,
and,
see, I automatically
she's never shown to be damaged enough to be necessarily suicidal, but it's being so blatantly obvious, because I saw it immediately, Eric saw it immediately, you obviously did, Chrissy too. You would think someone would have questioned and her mental health, or if she was assaulted by somebody.
Well, just Chrissy, I understand the point you're making, but for a movie that has repeatedly set stuff up and knocked it down, it was odd that they set that up and did not knock it down.
Well, it's one of two things, then. Either it's something that was deleted as a storyline.
That's what I guess.
Or one of three things. I guess one is that it was just left there as a subtle clue for you to pick up that she was despairing, and maybe she tried to do something and the father never knew about it. You know, another is that there was a deleted scene, but so much is tightly woven in this. You know, I'd have to think that if you had a teenage girl that tried to commit suicide, that she disappeared, that would have come up a couple of times, you know, and been too integrated, but maybe they just, you know, took it out. Or there is a possibility that there was something there that, you know, was not what you intended for you to see as the way that you saw it. But since I didn't see it, I don't know if that's a possibility. You know, but that happens sometimes with a movie where people see something and you see it once and you think it's a certain thing, and then it, in fact, it's something else.
And it could not be there. It could be that we're placing more importance on a shadow than there should be. But it seemed relatively intentional that they were bringing your attention to it.
Yeah, and it did look like rope burn or
a bruise.
Yeah, it looked pretty bad in my opinion. You know, it didn't look. You know, she either likes that sex thing where you choke yourself to death.
Autoerotic asphyxiation.
Yeah, that thing. Or she was sexually assaulted. I mean, not sexually assaulted, but physically assaulted by someone. Or she tried to suicide, and it was just a clue that she tried to suicide, but no one knew that she tried to suicide. I don't know. It was.
Well, I mean, because she has the. Okay, I'm just looking here. All right, we'll just keep talking. I'll see what I can find.
Okay.
Sure.
I just thought it was weird that all, because there are so many things in this movie, so many details that come up and then get circled back around to later. It was just odd that one didn't get circled back around to, that's all.
Yeah, and I do agree with you guys. I do agree with you there, Eric, but for me, I'm just saying that wasn't a problem. Because I was just
buying
into it.
I'm not saying it's a problem. I'm saying I don't get it.
Well, and also, too, the dad, unlike Vic, who, you know, obviously is obsessed with her son, and her son is her whole world, and yes, Margot is his whole world, but the dad clearly does not know how to communicate with his daughter and doesn't know what's going on in her life. So it would be easy enough for her to just cover that up so her father wouldn't see it.
Yeah. Okay, that's
fair. And that made sense to me, too, because maybe she didn't want to know. I mean, and if you fail at a suicide attempt, I mean, I would think that is worse for someone, you know? I mean, who wants to fail at suicide, really?
Yeah. A lot of people suicide to get attention, too, right? And they don't really want to die. I mean, that's
true, but I don't think that was the case here. I mean, we know she was going up to the lake for her alone time, and she was at peace there. And it was the only place she felt like she could run to feel solace from her own emotions. the UCAST videos and some of the subjects that we didn't get to see them all. But, you know, the UCAST was very that was more like the real her. You could really see how depressed and upset she was. So that's kind of why I did it didn't bother me. But I totally see you guys' point there, too, that there was no payoff. There was no specific payoff for that.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think it's more the fact that there was no payoff.
Well, and maybe that was just in there to show us what he eventually verbalizes, which is that he didn't know his own daughter. Because, of course, he thinks that they're really close because he loves her so much. But at the same time, he's been experiencing despair as well, perhaps to the point where he can't see hers.
Right. Right.
That's the best I can come up with.
Yeah, nobody looks like they're talking about it on about the neck thing on Reddit, just so you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very bizarre because Eric noticed it as much as I did. Because I asked Eric the question. I go, Eric, what was the deal with the marks around her neck? And they never nothing happened with it. And you go, oh my god, I thought that's the same thing. So it was kind of interesting. Yeah. So I don't know.
Want a commentary? I want a commentary.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, one of the things I want to say I liked, complete tangent here, because Eric, you talked about the technical stuff. Uh-huh. Yeah, we saw, with Unfriended Dark Web, you know, it starts with the guy hacking into the password.
Uh-huh.
And just by doing, you know, password, you know, and all the other obvious stuff to do that he, success, we've hacked in. Mm-hmm. I liked what he did to get into her, was it Facebook profile or... You know, that they made him have to go through, like, this chain of sending a password to a reminder.
That was really well done.
Until he finally found the one account that she had left, like, the password saved, and could use that to backtrack, and they kind of walked you through that, so...
Yeah, that was really cool.
What it was, and this is actually really, really kind of cool, because I didn't even think about this until, again, they mentioned it on the Slash Filmcast when I was listening to it, is that I think it was her Facebook account that had her mother's email address as the recovery address. So her mother probably set that account up for her because she was young. And that's how he was able to backtrack the whole thing, is change one and then go back and change them all.
Yep.
No, but I agree with you, Mike. Really... That whole sequence was really well done.
Oh, yeah. For them to have him break into the passwords without, you know, just... randomly picking, you guys are absolutely right. I'm on board. It was fantastic. It made sense. Reset the password, and there you go. And you reset it because it's linked to her, the mother's account, or whatever. So it was brilliant. I thought it was brilliant as well. Yeah.
The memorial one thing was also kind of interesting.
That was is that a thing? Does anybody know?
I don't know. I didn't get a chance to look it up, but I do know that they do leave a legacy and that sort of thing on these websites where the obituary is there.
Yeah,
the memorial one thing was interesting because the email that he gets is just like, you know, before the girl is even officially declared dead, it's like, we're here to, like, help you mourn your loss. And it was just so, like... total typical spammy internet shit.
I guess they exist.
Yeah, it's really, I'm looking here. Yeah.
Wow.
So top 10 online memorial websites.
Forevermist.com, iLasting, Immorial.com, Legacy.com, Mem.com, NeverGone.com, Queeper.com, which is just weird.
Yeah.
Remembered.com, Tributes.com, YourTribute.com. And, of course, now because of this, I am almost certainly going to get a whole shitload of spam about how, you know, I've lost loved ones.
Yes. Would you like to pay in advance? Oh, my gosh. I just thought that was really awesome, too. I mean, I have so little to say about this movie that's negative. I just really, really enjoyed this film.
There isn't really much negative about it. It's just that the ending is a little incredible.
Yeah, here's the thing. It may sound like I'm ripping on this movie. I'm really not. I did enjoy this movie a lot. It's just, unfortunately, a side effect of having done this podcast for as long as we have. It's just I analyze everything to death. And even when I like a movie, I still notice things that don't quite fit.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I kind of was doing that anyway prior to doing this podcast, because most of the films that I was watching prior to this podcast were the deep dramas and Fellini and Scorsese and Schrader and all this other crap.
Yeah, that was when you were 10 years old.
That's true. That's true. And well, that's where it all started, right? So I was already doing that, but you're right. I mean, we could nitpick this film to death if we really wanted to, because I'm sure there's parts, especially the ending, and the big twist, and how the woman reacts and all this other stuff. But for a film of this genre, it's pretty solid, and those nitpicks are pretty insignificant.
Considering the fact that for the whole movie you're basically staring at a computer screen, it was riveting. And that's hard to do. So I give the people that made this film a lot of credit for making that as interesting as it was.
I don't know. I mean, how much time a day do we spend looking at computer screens and the time just vanishes completely? You know, it's just, maybe it makes it easier to make it riveting.
Maybe.
You know.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. I mean, you would think, I think it was when we did the Unfriended episode, someone mentioned that. It's like we are watching computer screens forever. It's like, how is this movie going to be any good? And yet,
right.
you know, they can do it. You know, people can do it. So, and yeah, I mean, especially me and Eric and you too, Chrissy, we're in front of the desk with a computer in front of us 8 hours a day, if not longer.
Right. Yep.
I am a lot too. I do almost everything now in class. I present, you know, with my, I have a Surface 3 that I write on. I used to present. I used to do notes, to show videos and all that other, do worksheets, you know, so we're all used to looking at computer screens. And that's also, though, it gives us a nice, easy entry point, right? It's a point of commonality between the characters and the audience that all of us can go, oh, yeah, YouTube. I use YouTube. You know, yeah. I use Facebook.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know that my parents could identify with this film because they don't use that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not. They also haven't gone to a movie. I don't think my father's seen a movie since the last Indiana Jones movie.
Right,
that was a while ago.
Well, yeah. But I would say though that the story being told on the computer screen is honestly clear enough that I don't think you would need to necessarily know what the hell all that stuff was. I mean, if you didn't know what Facebook was, you would get it through context.
Yeah, but if you're not used to looking at a computer screen, which would be the case with my parents, you might have trouble following, like, the movements and knowing where to look and, you know, at particular times. It just may take longer to process the information is what I'm thinking.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, you could be right, I guess. See, my father, I mean, though he's a little dementia now, I could make sense, but yeah, he was using Facebook, you know, only 6 years ago and stuff, so he would have figured this, he could identify with this film. I mean, he saw Unfriended, and it was no problem, Unfriended 2, the dark web, so I guess it depends on your familiarity with the technology, whether or not it would work for you. So yeah.
Well, and I think we're almost to the point, maybe another 10, 20 years, but we're almost to the point where computers have been normal in everybody's life.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, cell phones and computers are pretty close to being standard as much as TVs and your car radio is, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I remember back 10 years ago, well, even further than that, because my mother's passed since then. But when my mother was alive, we would never rent VOD films back then, because my mother would always say, why spend $5 to VOD a film we could just go to Blockbuster and get for a buck. But back in those days, it was a little different.
Late fees,
right?
That's why.
Well, yeah. That's true. But it was also a little different, is a lot of films now are released directly to VOD instead of theaters. And so there's brand new films actually on VOD, not just theatrical films that are now doing their VOD run.
Right.
And so it's a little different. So nowadays, I think if my mother was around, she would most certainly rent a film for $5 because you cannot see it at a theater and it's not coming out.
If I could get personal for a moment, you were talking about your mother passing. My mother has passed too, less than 2 years ago. And the last several years of her life, she was in a nursing home because she had several strokes and she was not mobile anymore and she needed care. And she couldn't do anything. She couldn't go anywhere. And so probably the best present I've ever given to anybody was my brothers and I went in and got her an iPad and a subscription to Netflix. Man, I'll tell you what, because I knew she liked it, and I knew she used it and watched it. When I would go to visit her, she would want to watch stuff with me, and that was cool. But after she passed, I realized that there was this Netflix account just sitting out there still. And I was like, well, there's just, no need to pay for it every month anymore. It's not being used. But before I shut it down, I went in and looked. And just like he was kind of going back through his daughter's stuff and looking at his stuff, I went back and looked at all the stuff she had been watching on Netflix, and it was really kind of interesting. And I gave my brothers the login, and before I canceled the account, I let them go in and browse through her history, just get a feeling for what she had been watching. Because apparently she had a fascination with Hitler that I did not know about. She watched an awful lot of stuff about Hitler.
Let's hope she didn't find him sexy.
Right? She liked Dexter a whole lot. No, but it was kind of like not quite a memorial, but it gave me a little something to know my mother a little bit better, even though she was no longer with us. And I don't know why, but I felt that it connected to this movie.
Well, it connects to this movie because, again, we're talking about memorialization, but we've all seen that meme on the internet that says, I did a lot of stupid things when I was younger, and there's no record of it.
Right, thank God, right?
thank God. But these kids today, their whole lives
are
on the internet, and they're never going to escape it.
Well, here's
and,
the thing. In 20 years, nobody's going to be able to run for office.
Nobody. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, you know it.
Well, but wait, the other possibility is just the opposite, is that at that point, everyone's going to go, you know what? All of our shit's out there. Uh-huh. I did that too. That's come up with me in job interviews and, when I've hooked up with somebody on Tinder or whatever, they found that out about me. We've all been there. We've all done that. Who cares?
Well, let's hope
that's
so.
That's the other possibility.
Outrage culture, and I'm all about that.
This is all... I don't want to go there, but this is just, we've had moral panics before. This is just another moral panic, and I'm pretty sure it'll be passed in another 10 years. It's just going to really suck living through it.
Yeah.
That's my hope. And if I had a chance, I would bet on it, just like the satanic panic passed.
Yeah.
An alcohol panic passed.
That was fun. I got a couple of really good high school papers out of that.
So, there's no nuclear war with Russia yet, so.
Yeah, although we're back there. It went away, and now it's
we might
back.
Be back. We
it's
might
like
be back.
Like everything else from the 80s. It's back in vogue. So, I think we've said everything we have to say about this movie, right?
Yeah, it's a solidly entertaining film, and it's something that... I just think any anybody who's going to like, if you can stand these types of films, and I get it if someone says they just don't like movies where they're watching this voyeuristic thing, you know, whether it's a found footage or a, you know, video voyeur or whatever. All right, I get that, fine. But if you can dig those kind of films, and if you like your murder mysteries or, well, it's not really murder mystery, but if you like your mystery thrillers, crime dramas, whatever, I think this will appeal to you.
Yeah, I agree. I was immersed in this film the entire time. I mean, unfortunately, the ending, it's not horrendous, it just doesn't meet the quality of the 95% of the film prior to that. But it's a great mystery, great thriller, great police procedural as well, a great personal private investigation by a father, excellent twists with the brother and various other things that turn out to be false. So yeah, I mean, I love this film. I thought it was fantastic. I'm planning to get it on disc when it comes out, or VOD, and buy it when it comes out to watch it again, because I enjoyed it. I can't wait to show it to my wife. Great film. Eric?
I agree. I enjoyed this film a lot, even though it sounds like I'm nitpicking it to death. I really did. I plan on watching it again. If it has a commentary on disc when it comes out or on the VOD, I will purchase it, because I'd be really interested in hearing the director talk about how they did this.
Or the producer, because it seems like it's really the producer that is...
Any of them. Anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
I can recommend this film wholeheartedly.
Yeah, very good. Chris?
I highly recommend this. Everybody pretty much said what I wanted to say, particularly if you like crime dramas or mysteries, or if you watch a lot of ID Discovery. The story is tight. The acting is great. There are plenty of surprises. And this is just a fun ride. It's going to go by really quickly. I really enjoyed this movie. And, Phil, I agree with what you said. This is definitely going to be on one of my top 10 lists this year. I really thought this was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Eric, I think you were fair and you weren't really nitpicking too much. You really said more positive about this film than anything, so no worries there. I wanted to bring up one other thing, even though I hate bringing it up because of all the nonsense in the news about it now, about all these things, but I did like a film that's carried by... East Asian actors and actresses, Americans, but East Asian folk, because it hasn't really been done. I mean, ever since that movie that's Steve Young, is that the guy from Walking Dead?
Yes.
Right? Yeah, he was in that Mayhem movie. What was it called? Was it?
Yeah. Mayhem.
And how awesome he was in that. And then... You know, maybe we'll see a breakout. I mean, Battlestar Galactica had an actress that had a huge role that was East Asian as well. So maybe this is a new thing. And the number one film at the box office is...
Crazy Rich Asians.
Searching did well. I mean, it's not it's in the top five of the box office, but it had a very limited release, and it's a niche film with... and it's not an almost exclusively Asian cast like Crazy Rich Asians is, you know, but...
Right.
You know, it's for years, a lot of people, and I was one of them, you know, said that they never, you know, it's like they ruled out certain minority groups as stars because they said, well, people only want to go see white people only want to watch white people, and black people only want to watch black people or whatever. And that was the mindset and mentality in Hollywood.
Even in Caucasians with the fat Greek wedding, remember that? It's like weird culture. It's like, what? And but continue, Mike, your point.
Yeah, but, I mean, it didn't matter how many, you know, movies that made $1 billion that Eddie Murphy made or Denzel Washington made or Will Smith made. You know, they still had this, well, they're the exceptions to the rule. You know, and, well, no, people like good actors. Give them a freaking chance. And,
Good stories.
Right, and especially when it's something like this. You know, I understand it's a blockbuster. You got to go with the bankable star. I get that. But it's hard to make bankable stars. You've only had a handful of them, you know, over the decades. Why not risk it on, you know, if you get the most talent, you know,
because black actors have superstar actors that can carry films with Denzel Washington
right.
and Freeman or whatever. So it's been proven that it can happen, right?
But they were always considered the sort of the exception. It was weird, and they never made the risk on Asian actors or on Latino actors. Or they would downplay that, and you know, but like you look at Night of the Living Dead, and they got Dane Jones to play the Ben character. Why? Because he was just the best actor that was there. Films like this, you know, these actors are there. You know, God, I remember thinking, you know, right after 9/11, it was like, well, gee, everyone who's a Mediterranean or Arabic actor is now going to get a whole lot of job offers, but they're all going to be terrorists, you know. And sure enough, that's kind of where it was.
Sure.
Well. Here's the thing, is that this country has a long history of racism, and it's getting better.
Almost every country does.
In different directions, but I'm talking about this country because this is where most movies are made, at least most successful financial movies. It's getting better, but we're not quite there yet. And although I understand why Phil bristles a little bit at all the media attention, at the same time, I think it's important for Hollywood to understand because one of the reasons they haven't made a whole lot of movies with a diverse cast is because they didn't think they would make money on that. And that's their number one priority, as we've seen with a bunch of crappy Transformers movies. Really, I do think it's important that we're getting movies with diverse casts coming out, or even just, you know, like Crazy Rich Asians, where they have an all-Asian cast. I think it's important that they come out and they be successful so that Hollywood will see that you can make money doing this and not shy away from actors who aren't white.
Well, and you know what's great about this film, too, is that it's not any actor or could have played the role because it's not the ethnicity of the characters aren't even mentioned once.
It's irrelevant to the story. Completely.
Exactly.
Right.
Because they don't bring it up once at all. And so I felt this type of film is even more important than a Black Panther, in my opinion, because this shows that any ethnicity, religion, whatever, could play roles and lead an entire film. You know, so I think it's more important than Crazy Rich Asians, too, because, again, it's like Morgan Freeman's character in The Unforgiven. You know, it's important because it removes the diversity and makes them the same.
Just a person.
Yeah, a person.
Right, well, I mean, the difference with that and Black Panther is that Black Panther also had it going on behind the scenes, and that's where really Hollywood is notoriously not diverse. You know, it's one thing to have a black actor on the screen as opposed to a black actor with an all-black supporting cast that is a mega blockbuster, you know, with a black director and black cinematographer.
But this isn't a Korean film is what I mean. You know what I'm saying? It's
right.
not a well, Jewish that's... film or an Italian film or a black film.
Right.
It's just a film of people, and it just happens to be Asian Americans that are in the roles, and I thought it was fantastic. But go on.
Right. But I also think back, that... You know, I remember reading, Star Trek had the first interracial kiss on television, and they were always so afraid of doing that because they were afraid of a backlash, particularly in the South.
Well, that was a different time as well.
Wait, let me finish. So they aired it, and they were ready, and they got nothing. You know, there was no
issue.
There was no issue generated. There was no backlash from it. You know, they got one letter that kind of said, well, like, you know, I'm not really in favor of miscegenation, but hey, you know, if a red-blooded American guy like Captain Kirk can kiss a black girl, then okay, I'm fine with that. You know, it's all right, there you go. That was it. That was the worst letter they got. You know, so now obviously 20 years earlier you had Jackie Robinson, which was a much bigger issue. You know, but and so maybe it's sometimes just the timing. You know, but yeah, take the risks, right? I mean, it's worth taking the shot. And so I agree with you entirely. Sometimes I think the Hollywood is too risk averse, and they don't take chances when they should. And in this case, it's paid off, and I'm glad they did it.
That's where we as a society would end up eventually, where we can have movies with people instead of having to identify them as white or Asian or black or whatever.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And hopefully that will happen someday, and that'll be a good thing.
Yes.
Any other things anybody want to bring up? Anything?
That's it.
All right, sounds good. So that's Searching. Excellent reviews. I think it's 93% or 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. As Mike said, it's not a big box office success, but it did make the top 10, 5 million.
I'm fairly sure the production cost on this was able to be held at a fairly low amount, so I'm pretty sure it's already profitable.
Yeah, you're probably right. Let's see if Wiki says... Well, no, it doesn't say.
They stopped putting that up on IMDb.
Oh, I wonder why.
I think there's a premium subscription you can pay for where they will give you that information.
Oh, okay. Wiki sometimes lists it, but this film, it doesn't. It just lists the box office, not the...
Yeah, I think they have it on older movies, but they're not listing it with newer ones.
Interesting. Typical Hollywood. All right, so Searching, still at the theaters. Go check it out quick. If not, it'll be on VOD probably near the end of the year, and worth checking out there as well. This, I think, Eric, this is going to be one of those films that we're talking about now that no one will know about or care about, and then when it hits VOD and disc, people, it'll suddenly reappear on Facebook like, oh my god, did you see this awesome film called Searching?
Yeah. That happens with a lot of them. Yep, I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, this is also because of the format of the film. I can see a lot of people shying away from paying $15 to see it in the theater. So yeah, once it hits Netflix or whatever.
I wonder if this movie would actually be more effective watching it on a computer.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering that too. I'm looking when I get the disc or when it comes on Netflix and I want to rewatch it, I'm going to just sit and watch it on my computer and just see what the difference is feeling like that. It just sounds like an interesting thing to just try, an interesting experiment, because I have not watched Unfriended on my computer yet. I have the original Unfriended, which, honestly, compared to this, that thing really looks like crap.
Well, they intentionally made that one look like crap because they were showing the load times and all that crap because, again, that was, 5 years ago or something?
No, but I mean, in terms of story and stuff, the first Unfriended compared to this, I mean, I don't know.
No, you said the look. I thought you were talking about the look, not the screen.
Oh, part. I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't mean that.
Oh, you meant the story.
Meant the story. I think, you know, Phil, you were possibly kicking around a new subgenre or something like that. I think we're going to see more of this style of film, and I honestly hope they are all as good as this one. Because I think it's a very effective way to tell a story if it's done well.
I'm calling it techno-foyerism, and I'm going to make it happen.
Well, besides...
We are putting that phrase right now.
Besides The Den, all the rest of them are by the same producer. So I think this guy, I think a director of Wanted, the James McAvoy, Angelina Jolie film, is the producer of all of these films that are like this, except for The Den. So as long as he's doing it, not that The Den was bad, because that was pretty damn good too, but as long as this guy's doing it, they're probably going to be half decent.
I'm making Fetch happen. This is techno-voyeurism.
Techno-voyeurism. It works for me.
All right, we're going to start calling it that, so everybody out there, pay attention, because when it becomes a thing, you heard it here first, folks.
That's right.
Yeah, so Dark Discussions does horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, drive-in, and
techno-voyeurism.
There you go. We discuss it all.
So when you write up your little description for this, Phil, you could say Searching is a techno-voyeurist vehicle.
That's right. Eric will get credit.
Yes, we're going to discuss the new techno-voyeurist thriller. Searching. Yeah.
So in 3 months from now, when people see it on VOD, they're going to go, oh my god, have you seen this awesome film? Just like last week, everybody was saying this about Upgrade, and 3 months ago.
No, that was just you, Phil. You just posted it 12 times.
Best film ever. Best film ever.
Just like you're the only one talking about Peppermint right now.
Dude,
13% Rotten Tomatoes.
Dude, it's going to be awesome.
How much?
13%.
It's politically motivated that it's got better.
13%.
It's a
13.
It's supposed to be anti-liberal type of film, I guess.
You're
so that's why
not
people
making me watch that.
Dude, come on, it's good.
Nope,
you haven't seen
no,
it.
It's not,
dude. We got to do. We're doing an episode on it.
No, we're not.
All right,
I'm so glad I'm going to be in Disney World while you guys battle this.
All right, we'll talk about this offline.
No, there's no conversation. If you're doing this, it's a solo cast.
Oh, for Christ's sake. This is ridiculous. All right, we'll discuss.
No, we won't.
Anyway, all right, so that's Searching 2018 at the theaters now. See it quick before it's gone. Otherwise, wait to VOD. With that all stated, Eric, what are you saying?
All right. Thank you for tuning in and listening to us talk about the techno-voyeuristic Searching. Come back next week. We'll have another title.
Oh, I love it.
Peppermint?